recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold.
Crime creates ripple effect of pain throughout generations. It affects the victims, their families, investigators, and society as a whole. I sit down and interview the people directly involved with these cases and let them tell their story from their point of view. Hopefully, we can all learn something positive from their perspective. This week, we look at one of the first instances of a set of murders being classified as a thrill killing. Horror descended on a small town in the western part of the state in rural Indiana and in what is now known as the Hollinsburg Massacre. Four people, Roger Drollinger, Danny Stonebreaker, Michael Wright, and David Smith, shotgunned to death four teenage boys in their home and left their mother for dead. People to this day assume it had something to do with drugs, or maybe some other targeted attack, and maybe even the boys owed Drollinger money. But as you'll hear in today's episode, that's not true, at least according to Mike McCarty, who lived in Hollinsburg, Indiana at the time of the murders, and he is my interview for this episode. Mike remembers the massacre as it happened. His father was involved because he was a state police trooper, and also very well known in the community. Valentine's Day 1977 will never be forgotten. Drollinger had been released from prison earlier, and the people who knew him said he was just different. He was always a guy that was over the top bad, but for some reason, he was ready to do so much more when he was released back in about January 1977. And you'll hear from Mike and talk about Roger's mindset then, and how he and his gang went around the town looking for people to kill for absolutely no reason. Mike is the author of the book Choking in Fear, and he interviewed many people for that book, including Danny Stonebreaker, one of the men who committed the terrible crime. 2 weeks before the killing, Drollinger and three other gang members had cut themselves and made a blood oath. Each of them promised to kill someone, and if one of them did not, the other gang members would kill that member of the gang. The reason for the killing? Just to see what it would be like. They all obtained shotguns in Crawfordsville, Indiana, and on Valentine's Day 1977, Drollinger, Michael Wright, Stonebreaker, and David Smith roamed around the western Indiana countryside hunting for their victims, any victim, to feel whatever it felt like to deliberately snuff out a human life. On an isolated road near Raccoon Lake, the Drollinger gang spotted a house trailer with two new cars parked outside. They parked the car down the road and crept up to the trailer. Drollinger cut the electrical wires, and a few moments later, the three other gang members burst through the door. They shined their flashlights on Betty Spencer and three of her boys and then ordered them to lie on the floor and to not look around. After he was assured it was safe to enter the home, Drollinger walked in. A moment later, he then heard a car pull up outside. It was another one of Betty Spencer's sons. As he walked in the door, he was ordered to lay on the floor with the others. One of the killers asked the victims if they had any more money or guns. One gang member pocketed the money, which was only about $30, while the others found the rifle hidden in the house. Then Roger Drollinger walked behind each of the teenage boys who were on the floor, tapped them on the foot, and asked, "How old are you, son? How old are you, boy?" On the ground was Betty's son, Gregory Brooks, who was 22, her stepsons, Raymond Spencer and Reeve Spencer, who were 17 and 16, and Ralph Spencer, who was 14 years old. After that, he ordered his cohorts to turn off the flashlights and put them aside. Four shotguns went off, blasting the life out of the four boys on the floor. But the mother, Betty Spencer, her wig saved her life. The killers thought it was her scalp as the gun went off. Leaving the blood-splattered scene, Drollinger's gang decided to take one new car parked outside and then drive off with it. Two gang members went in the car they brought, and the other stolen car was filled with the other two gang members. The killers laughed as they abandoned the car, planning and hoping someone else would take it and get caught by police and end up facing murder charges. Now, as for Betty, she was able to make it down the hill to a neighbor's house where she pleaded with him to call police. They did, and soon enough, police were searching the area for the killers, but never could find them. The next morning, Drollinger appeared in court in Crawfordsville, Indiana, to testify in his own drug trial, acting as if nothing happened the night before. He remained at large for weeks. His lawyers set up a live TV interview eventually with Drollinger and Channel 6 news team, where Drollinger and his wife and a baby proclaimed his innocence in the crime. He did finally turn himself in for orchestrating the killings later. He then went to trial in Hartford City, Indiana, and convicted and sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms in prison. Drollinger died in his cell in Wabash Valley Correctional Facility on Wednesday, January 29th, 2014. As for the other 3, David Smith and Daniel Stonebreaker are in Pendleton Correctional Facility, and Michael Wright is at Pendleton Treatment Unit. I'm excited for you to hear from Mike, because we talk about how this case essentially affected how the world saw murders, because it can happen for no reason at all. Please enjoy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. Today, I'm with Mike McCarty.
Who are you? And what do you do?
Yeah, Mike McCarty. Grew up here in Indiana. I've been the CEO, founder of Safe Hiring Solutions for the last 15 years, violent crime detective for about 9 years prior to that in Nashville, Tennessee.
What do you want people to know about you that maybe I can say before the interview section? Because the interview portion is its own segment. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a little intro about the crime itself, who you are, go into our interview, and then tag out at the end. It's that simple.
Yeah, the honest truth is what we're here to talk about, the book, the story itself, is really kind of the foundation for everything I've done in my life since then. I mean, it kind of set the tone for interest in law enforcement, which then's led into, you know, the career in creating violence prevention programs and solutions for groups.
We're talking about the Valentine's Day murders out in
Hollinsburg, Indiana.
Yep. I don't know whether or not to call them the Hollinsburg murders or the Valentine's Day murders. Raccoon Lake, I've heard too.
Yeah, no, I think Hoosiers would refer to them as the Hollinsburg murders.
Yeah.
Valentine's Day kind of gets them confused with those murders in Chicago.
And then also, yeah, those murders too. The guy who committed these murders, Roger Drollinger, ultimately, this guy was put away. He was convicted and he has passed away since then.
Correct. Yeah, there's actually 4 of them. He's the ringleader. There's 3 other guys that are still alive serving time in Pendleton, Indiana, the reformatory.
What made you write this book? What was it about the case that stuck with you?
Well, yeah, it's pretty simple, actually. I was about 9 years old, lived about 2 miles north of where the murders happened. My dad was with the Indiana State Police. And I can remember coming home from school the first day, and I knew something had happened because the mood in our house was totally different. Phone was ringing off the wall. Back then, you didn't have cell phones. You had phones on the wall. My dad's answering the telephone. I'm hearing one-sided conversations, and I knew something big had happened. And then my dad's involved in the investigation. He's leaving at night. My mom's scared to death. You know, I try to go to bed. She's looking out the windows. So, jeez. I mean, that's really had a huge impact on a kid. Just first time I'd ever felt fear in my life.
You remember that in the cover of the book. It's called Choking in Fear, by the way. And if you want to look it up, you can go on Amazon. You can find it there. But it is popular from what I see on Amazon. And also, the people I talk to who have connections to this case, I talked to a victim who got away. I shouldn't call her a victim. I should say a potential victim who actually was followed and got away and realized later on, because of your book, that was her, that she actually was the one who got away. So that stuff has really stuck with people. It seems it really made an impact on that community in a negative way.
Well, it's had a huge impact on that community. And I think even yet today, I think what the book has done, I've been to Rockville twice on book signings and have a speaking engagement and just crowded the library. And I think a lot of people still hold on to a myth that this was not a random act of violence, that this was actually a very targeted drug-related event, which it absolutely wasn't. And I think that's kind of the perspective why the book's so popular is I've got a surviving mother who helped with the book. And I also have one of the killers, Daniel Stonebreaker, who also provided, as well as all the state police detectives that are assigned to the case, I had access to.
I'm sure it made it a little bit easier for you to be able to talk to law enforcement. You are law enforcement, so being able to understand it, you absolutely are sure that this wasn't a targeted thing, that this was a random act of violence.
100%. Mm-hmm. That's one of the first questions I asked Daniel Stonebreaker, and actually when I started talking to Dan, who was kind of Drollinger's right-hand guy, when I started talking to Dan, I wasn't writing a book. I was actually, I went to the prison, I wrote letters to all for the killers. And I was just wanting to really put some closure to it myself because there were so many unanswered questions. And so when I met with Dan the first time, I came up as a detective. Hmm. And so the DOC let me in because I came in as a police officer and I was asking questions for me. But the last question I asked him that day before I left, I said, there's a lot of people think that you went to that house because those kids were involved in drugs and it was some kind of drug debt. And he looked at me and he said, it's absolutely not true. He said, this was 100% random, and he explained how they had driven all over the county that night looking at houses. Should we stop here? No, not this one. I don't like that one. Let's try this one. Until they, Drollinger drove past this house, saw four vehicles in the driveway, thought they were probably having a poker game or didn't realize they had a bunch of children. And he said, that's the house. And so he said it was pure. He said, I thought I was in a different state. Had no idea who they were.
Was there any remorse when you talked to Stonebreaker?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. And I think it was the toughest thing for the mother because often I would come up here from Tennessee. I was a detective at the time. So I would come up, I'd go to the prison, I'd talk to Dan for 2 hours, then I'd go over to Rockville. Mm-hmm. And actually, even before that, she was living in Atlanta, Georgia. But through the process of me writing the book, she started to feel comfortable enough. She moved back to Indiana. So I would go from the killer to the surviving mother back and forth. And so I found myself asking lots of questions and answering questions for her.
What are some of the interesting tidbits that you were able to find out through those conversations? Because I bet you found out stuff that you didn't expect. And then now you have the answers to maybe some of those initial questions. What were some of those initial questions that you had that you brought to Stonebreaker and were able to go back and forth with?
There was, over the years, and we probably communicated for 3 or 4 years, if not longer, and they were usually in lengthy letters. I mean, a lot of the communication in person was more just a discussion limited to time. Mm-hmm. I would write out 20 questions and he would spend 2 weeks writing answers. I still have all that.
That's amazing.
I have all the state police files. The surviving mother gave me copies of journals. She wrote letters to the boys after they were killed. She was in a hospital. She didn't have a chance to say goodbye. So, I mean, a lot of the questions were just the typical questions. Okay, was this really a random act of violence, or was this something more than a random act of violence? Did you drive past our house that night, which I heard, and did Drollinger joke, hey, we ought to stop and kill a pig and his family? Stonebreaker corroborated that. They drove right past our house. They joked. My dad had interacted with 3 of the 4 killers. I mean, they're in our community.
That's insane.
It's absolutely insane. But that was the big question, is just the randomness of the act. And then he confirmed that when they left that house, they stole one of the Spencer's vehicles, which was a 76 Thunderbird. And the idea was they were going to go to another house, just like the Tate-LaBianca murders. Drollinger went to kill another family, leave the Spencer's vehicle there. But what happened is when they left and they were coming back down the county road, Mike Wright was driving the rented vehicle behind them, started flashing the lights, come up beside them. He had a scanner. He said, hey, the mother lived. And police are being dispatched. So that's when they freaked out. They went and dumped that car. They went down through Shade State Park, Pine Hills Nature Preserve, threw the weapons out. And then they scattered.
And they were on the run.
They were on the run for, it was nearly 3 weeks before they were identified. But Stonebreaker was actually brought in for questioning within 3 days. Here's some irony in the case. Stonebreaker actually had cousins that lived in Marshall, Indiana, which is same school district, probably 10 miles away. Some of the kids that were killed were friends with some of Stonebreaker's cousins, but Stonebreaker comes from the black sheep side of the family. And so through that, one of the older cousins was a police officer in Lafayette. At that time, he was a rookie patrol officer. And he picked up the Lafayette Journal-Courier because the mother had been able to articulate well enough to create these incredible sketches, yeah, of the killers, just hugely accurate. But when Bill Stonebreaker, police officer, opens up the paper, he said, I almost vomited. He said, I knew that was my cousin Dan. But he said he called down to the Montgomery County Jail because Dan and Roger had been arrested in August of 76 because of all this major drug trafficking. He thought he was still in jail. Well, when he called down to the jail, they said, no, he was released. And so he said, I absolutely knew. So he called a trooper named Dave Blue. Dave since passed, good friend of my dad's. He called my dad and Dave Blue, and he said, hey, look, that's my cousin Dan. Well, Dave Blue, nobody thought anybody would have done that in our community. Yeah. And so out of respect for Bill Stonebreaker, Dave Blue brings him in for an interview. But when he brought him into the Montgomery or the Crawfordsville Police Department to interview him, Dan Stonebreaker told me on the first visit, he said, the mistake they made is, he said, I wanted to admit it right then. He said, I was absolutely horrified at what I'd done. But he said, they asked my mom and dad to come and sit in the interview room while they talked to me. And he said, as weird as this sounds, I couldn't admit to killing in front of my mom. But he said, every question they asked, I'd go, huh? Because he said, my ears were still ringing from the shotguns. He said, if you'd have pulled my shirt back, I had bruising on my shoulders. He said, obviously, they didn't think I did it, so they weren't asking the right questions. So they really had the right people. They even, the detectives thought it was, you know, Drollinger high on the suspect list. But Drollinger was on trial that week. I mean, he literally was on trial. He was going to be tried as habitual. He got 40 years for the drug trafficking. So Roger actually goes on the witness stand the Friday before the murders, and he's testifying in his own defense. So Friday was basically his attorney, Niles Stanton, questioning. Pretty easy. But you know, over the weekend, the prosecutor's going to take over on Monday, so you're going to have this absolutely grilling come Monday morning. They commit this murder going into Sunday night, into Monday morning, the 14th. Roger gets home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's back on the witness stand at 9 o'clock that next morning. Courtroom full of
less than 24 hours.
Oh, not even 6 hours.
What
after.
Kind of person needs to be? What kind of criminal needs to, or has the ability to do that? To compartmentalize.
I mean, you know, we use that term freely. People are sociopaths. Most people are not. But I mean, I think that is really a clear indicator, because I've read through the trial transcripts. I've talked to the officers that were there. They said he was engaging. He wasn't distracted. His testimony was fantastic. So the state police investigators, who were great, Lloyd Heck, Barney Thrasher, who's since passed, they thought Roger, but then they said, no, he's on trial. There is no way a guy on trial for his life would be out doing this while he's on trial. So they dropped him down on the list.
What was he on trial for again? Remind me.
Oh, they'd been selling narcotics to undercover officers for months. So he had like 6 or 7 felony drug resale charges.
That's, I think what I can take from that is that, first of all, it's unbelievable how the lengths that people will go to when they do stuff like this to not get caught. And what can really change someone's mind? Like the mother sitting in the interrogation room with Stonebreaker. That's amazing to me that can happen. And I'm sure as a police officer, it's probably interesting to you too.
Well, the interesting thing is Drollinger's a killer. I mean, he's just a cold-blooded killer. The other three guys involved in these murders were capable of murder, obviously. They did it.
They all pulled the trigger?
They all pulled the trigger. But they're like a lot of kids we see today, just teetering on that fence, one wrong influence, and it really shows how far somebody can go. I mean, if you set my dad down today, 35 years with Indiana State Police, he knew Dan Stonebreaker, used to pull into a gas station where he worked. I can remember he said the last thing he said to Dan before all this happened was, Dan, get your shit together. Drollinger's going to take you someplace you don't want to go. And Dan goes, I was too cocky to even listen to that. But it shows you what people are really capable of under that kind of influence.
How much does the small community play a factor into that influence and to what they did? Let's try to explain it to people that Indiana, we're talking west, right by the Illinois border. You're almost, are you in the Central Time Zone over there?
No.
No?
We would have been at the time, probably.
But either way, just to give people an
very
idea
rural.
Where it is.
Yeah.
Rural, lakes, woods, running around, acting crazy at night, doing donuts in the fields, whatever, drinking, and you can kind of get away with it all. That seems to be a perfect breeding ground for something like this to happen when you have a sociopath who's helping others.
Well, there's a real progression. I mean, there's so many ironic pieces to this you know, one act. This had been going on for years. And I've talked to people that have taught him in high school, coached him in high school. Not one person.
And this isn't, you're talking Drollinger, not Stoltenberg.
Drollinger. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not one person ever looked at me and said, I can't believe Drollinger did that. Every single person I talked to was not surprised. Can't say that about the other three. Almost universally, anybody taught them, little shits, ornery, but not, didn't think they were capable of murder. But I mean, with this was a, Roger was also in jail, just like, Drollinger was in jail, just like Stonebreaker. Stonebreaker got out right before Christmas. Drollinger, they finally allowed his father to post their farm as bond on January 14th, 30 days before, and actually less than that, because the trial started a week before the murders, so around February 7th. So 3 weeks before he goes on trial, a judge finally allows him to put the farm up. I mean, if they would have not allowed him, after 7 months in jail, to post bond, none of this would have ever happened. Stonebreaker said as soon as he got out of jail, he said he was totally different. He said, I can remember sitting and watching Helter Skelter, the movie was on primetime, and he said he was mesmerized by that. And he said all this language about a family and killing, he said he had a totally different demeanor. It was almost like he knew he was going away, and he just had this thirst to kill, and he had a short window to do it because he was going on trial in about 3 weeks. And so for about a week before the murders, I mean, they would travel down Interstate 74 to Danville, Illinois, where they picked up a lot of their drugs. That's where the young lady talked about that was driving, I think, a VW Bug, and they pulled up next to her, and Stonebreaker said, I'm leaning out the window. I got a shotgun pointed at her, and I mean, her eyes are gigantic. And what he's talking to me about is how all these things happened for a week, and I couldn't pull the trigger. But he said Drollinger was trying to get me to a point of killing her. Car comes over the hill. We pull it back in. Off we go. We break into a house over in West Central Indiana like 3 days before the murders. And he said we line the family up. But he said the difference is we wore masks. He said we always had masks on. We would line them up, steal some things, beat them up a little bit. But we never killed anybody. But he said, when we drove past the Spencer's home, after looking at all these homes all night long, when Roger said, that's the house, they pulled down a lane that's set below the house, and they're looking back up, lights off, they're planning the murders, and Dan goes, I started to put a handkerchief around my face, and Roger grabbed it, and he goes, no need, nobody lives tonight. And he said, so I took
that's
this.
Chilling.
It's chilling. And Dan goes, I had a white sweater on. He said, I took it off. And I said, why'd you take it off? And he said, because I didn't want to get blood on it. So I said, you went in with a T-shirt on? He goes, I was bare-chested. And the wind chill was like 10, 12 below zero, something like that night. He said,
adrenaline.
That's just where they were at. And he said there was no way out. He said there was no turning back. He said,
there is always a way to turn back.
Sure there is. He knows that now.
Yeah, yeah. But we're also in a different mindset than they are.
We think differently.
Yeah. It's just sad to hear that and know that he has the regrets, because I believe that people can change. And
yeah.
He was in a spot where he possibly could. Drollinger, a little different.
Yeah.
You're saying you don't think he would have ever changed.
No.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example.
Sure.
His wife at the time, who my dad had arrested, one of the first arrests he made of Roger was for statutory rape because she was 15 at the time. Well, then she later married him. She didn't divorce him until like 5-6 years ago. She never had anything to do with him when he was in prison, never took the kids, had no interaction. But I heard through people that work close to her that have told me things that she was so scared of him, even from prison, that she remained married to him for some 30-some years before she ever divorced him. Fear
wow.
that he would get her even from prison.
You've talked to all these people. I think I'm 100% sure that you know this case inside and out. What is something that maybe hasn't come out that is something interesting that you've learned over the years that maybe isn't publicly known, other than the fact, you know, you disputed that myth now.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that's the big piece, and the big takeaway for me is, one, it could have been anybody in West Central Indiana that night, and had Betty not survived, the mother, there would have been another family killed that night. And I think people don't really realize that. And I think they still hold true over in that West Central Indiana area that this is drug related, because for them to admit it's random, they have to accept the fact it could have been them. And nobody's 40 some years later wants to accept the fact that it could have been them.
What does this say about society in general? Knowing your history, you have a different perspective on how things happen. I do too. As a reporter, we see this stuff all the time. I'm covering it from one angle. You have the other. What are you saying? What does this say about people?
This is one of the most unique cases. Matter of fact, People magazine in like 1987 actually listed this as one of the 20 most shocking crimes in American history. I think a lot of what you see every day, a lot of what I see every day, we're starting to see some more randomness to violence, but a lot of it, there is some connection, right? Domestic violence or a robbery. There's something you can put your, you know, fingers around and say, okay, I see why that happened. Not that it should have happened, but I understand wrong place, wrong time, these things happen. I think what's still unique about this one is it's really not that common to have these purely, you know, random acts of horrible violence. We hear about them more today because, I mean, my gosh, where's social media and 24-hour news cycles didn't exist when these things happened. So I think we're more desensitized to it, and people maybe don't necessarily understand the gravity. And that's why when I read about the incident that happened in Wisconsin with the young girl, sees her at a bus stop, and the next thing you know, he shoots the dad through the front door and shoots the lock off and kills the mother and kidnaps her. I mean, that's an evil that I don't think people can really appreciate how evil that is. And that's Roger Drollinger. I mean, that's what was inside of him.
That Wisconsin case is very similar when you explain it that way to the Drollinger case. The only difference is this guy did it by himself. What made Drollinger grab the other three? Why did he need them?
He was really a wimp. If you look at all these houses they broke into, even the Spencer home that night, he's the last one in. Why? He tells them he's cutting phone lines, he's doing these things. He's not. There was never a phone line cut. What he's doing is if there's any resistance, he's gone. And so he needed them to carry this out. Huh. And he surrounded himself with these kinds of people. Young people, you know, horrible home lives, highly influenced by this guy. And there was a whole series of guys that ran in this gang. And I've had numerous conversations over the years with others that were friends in this group. And I ended every one of the interviews by asking them, what would have happened if you were there that night? Dead silence every single time. Every one of them would like to think I wouldn't have walked in that house. But when they have to chew on that, they could have just... So there could have been 6-7 different people in that car with Drollinger that night.
He's an influential person, able to manipulate.
Oh, yeah.
Sociopath.
Mesmerizing.
Yeah.
He's highly intelligent.
Sure.
Yeah.
The police looking for them, that after they scattered, they went down the hill, got rid of the stuff, dumped the guns. Now, Drollinger had to be in court the next day.
Yep.
The others, obviously, Stonebreaker went home, but the other two, why couldn't police find them as quickly or be able to pin somebody together?
Yeah, so David Smith was the youngest. He was 17 at the time and probably the most influenced. Mike Wright was the fourth. Mike was there by association. He was friends with Stonebreaker. Stonebreaker will tell you he feels enormous guilt. Even though Mike pulled the trigger, was the first one that shot, he was only there because Stonebreaker brought him into that group. So they actually went to court the next day. So Stonebreaker and Smith, I don't remember if Wright was there, but Stonebreaker and Smith were sitting in the courtroom the next morning. First break, Drollinger said, you know, get the hell out of here. I mean, there's cops everywhere. He's afraid somebody's going to put this together. Mike Wright starts to get real jumpy over the next couple days. And so finally, Drollinger's like, you need to get out of town. So he buys a bus ticket to San Jose, California. He'd been in the Navy, I think. He was in the military. So he had some relationships in San Jose. So he takes a one-way bus ticket to San Jose. He's gone. And the others don't flee. Stonebreaker never flees. Smith and Drollinger, obviously, he's on trial for another week. And then he has a sentencing hearing comes up about 3 weeks after the murders. And at that point, he knows he's going to prison. So that's when he and Smith actually flee to Florida. And it was about the time the state police detectives were kind of coming back 360 and saying, we need to take another look at this gang. And about that time, another businessman just retired over in West Central Indiana that ran with this group was on probation. He had called Dave Blue, the trooper I talked about earlier, and said, hey, Dave, you meet me in the probation officer in the office in the morning, I'll tell you who did these murders. I figured it out. They were already
coming. How did he figure it out?
Because he'd asked Stonebreaker a lot of questions, and he was starting to figure out based on the composites and how they looked and how they were acting and just little comments that were coming up.
The composites seem to be the thing that really gets it.
They're straight on. I mean, yeah. If you take those composites and stick them next to, there's only three, and that's because Drollinger didn't come in the house. You had Smith and Stonebreaker came in the back door, flying in the back door. Wright came in the front door. Betty was sitting in a nook in the kitchen. That's the mother. And so in that few split seconds, she's able to absorb that much. And she said, I focused on their faces, their eyes and features, because I knew they could change their hair color, their hair type, their beard.
She's a policeman's wife.
Yeah, she
or
got it.
Not a policeman's wife. She's a policeman's dream. I'm
right.
Sorry.
No, absolutely.
Somebody who wants to do that. That's amazing.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing, because they immediately got them on the floor, face down, so she was only sneaking peeks at them, and then they shut the lights off, so it wasn't easy to see.
Wow. There's something else working there that's something higher power.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Can you go over what exactly happened that night? What have you learned? What are some of the state police records say? I really want
to come into the house.
Let's talk about what happened that night when they come into the house.
Yeah. Once they come into the house, you know, Drollinger had instructed them, get them in a central location, get them face down on the floor, basically get it secure. He always talked about, you know, seek and secure. And so they come in, get everybody down, they get them into the front room. There's actually three of the four boys are home. One of them was working at if you go to Raccoon State Park, the lake entrance, there's a restaurant right across the street, Hollinsburg Lounge, I think it's still called that. He bused tables there, so he was not home yet. And so they line up three of the boys, got two of them out of bed, put them on the floor. Betty's on the floor, face down. They're kind of going through, tearing up the house. Keith, the husband who had left for work, he worked for, I think, Channel 13. He was an engineer here in Indianapolis, and so he does the kind of midnight shift like you do. He had just left like an hour before, and so he had all this equipment because he was getting ready to launch a radio station. Well, they didn't know what it was, so they started destroying this equipment because they thought it could, you know, they could communicate with it. That's when Drollinger came into the house once the lights were off and people were secure, because Betty said, I could tell there was an authoritative voice now just walked into the house, and he started ordering and lining them up. And then her son came home. She was praying that he wouldn't come home from work. And then she heard a scuffle at the front door, and, you know, he was being slammed down on the floor. She had three boys, Betty, and then the fourth was her biological son, who was 22, was on her right side. You had Smith and Stonebreaker standing to the left of them, and you had Drollinger and Smith at their feet. So Stonebreaker, Wright both have sawed-off shotguns, and Smith has a sawed-off shotgun. Drollinger has a pistol, but he's not firing. Stonebreaker said at one point he looked over at them, and he nodded his head, and he said, Mike Wright, open fire, and just started going down the line. Dan said he fired once, his gun jammed, and he was messing with it. Smith opened fire. So you got crossfire with shotguns in a close living room space. And he said all of a sudden the shooting stopped. And he said Drollinger was looking at him like he didn't think Dan had pulled the trigger. He wanted to make sure everybody had pulled the trigger. And so Stonebreaker threw him the weapon. He cleared it. And Drollinger said, shoot the bitch again. And Betty goes, I was laying there trying to be still, because she said, I knew the boys on either side of me were dead. Because after the first shooting started, her son Greg on the right got hit. And he raised up. Now, what Betty heard him say was, oh, God, I'm flying. Oh, God, I'm flying. Stonebreaker said what he said was, oh, God, I'm dying. Oh, God, I'm dying. And he said it so pissed Drollinger off that he didn't lay there and die. Drollinger takes the shotgun out of Smith's hand, walks up behind him, grabs him by the back of his hair, puts the shotgun up, and Stonebreaker said it was like his face come off, and just, he said, I watched it go across the room. And so Betty knew that the boys on either side were dead when the shooting stopped. She tries to go calm, and she said she hears what turns out to be Drollinger going down the line, kicking them to see if they're alive. So she tries to go limp, and she said as soon as he kicks her, he turns and he says, shoot the bitch again. She goes, oh my God, I've lived, now I'm going to die. And she didn't know if the younger two were alive or dead. And Stonebreaker said he aimed, and for some reason, he said, I just lifted the gun. He said, I don't know why. He said, I couldn't shoot her again. So he said, I shot into the couch. Well, you and I know, if you're shooting a shotgun, you don't have to be very accurate to kill somebody at that range. So what it does, it catches her wig, the trailing buckshot, knocks it off, and in the dark, they think it's her head, and they leave, and that's how she survives. Crazy. She said it's when they walked out the door, of course she waited, she jumped up, saw him leaving in her vehicle and the other vehicle, but she said it sounded like a waterfall in the house. And she said that was the blood draining out of her boys. And so she yelled out, is anybody alive? Is anybody alive? Nobody answered. And so she ran out the back door.
Was she injured?
Oh yeah, she'd been shot in the back, and the back of the head. She wrapped a towel around her head because she didn't know how bad. Ran next door, was knocking on a door. Harold Eskew, the guy that lived there, answers the door. Of course, freaks this poor old guy out. But that's where the police notification was so fast. That's why they hadn't even gotten to the end of her road when the police were being dispatched on the scanner.
She's a hero.
Major hero.
Have you ever heard of something so brutal? Have other things hit you similar to what this would hit you like?
This is close as I've ever been to any, and I'll be honest, I was a violent crime detective. I've seen a lot of violence in the 9 or 10 years I was in law enforcement. I hear things on TV that appear like they probably are this bad, but I was able to see the crime scene photos. I mean, I've seen what happened inside that house. And I actually asked Lloyd Heck, who had been a detective for 26 years, when we were going through this process of interviews, I asked him one time, what impact did this have? And he said, I've never seen anything like this in my 26 years. And he had investigated all kinds of murders. He said this was by far the worst thing he'd ever seen in his life.
And you, from a violent crimes perspective, I can only imagine walking into stuff like that and being that detective and having to deal with that. And then, obviously, like we keep talking about, small community.
Yeah.
This is happening too. And then you have the impact. Your dad's investigating. You're a kid. You hear about this stuff. And then you now learn about it later on.
Well, you think 3 weeks that nobody knows who did this. I mean, the political pressure. I mean, I didn't know this at the time.
Sure.
Looking back, I mean, the political pressure was intense. I mean, this is national news media. A lot of pressure on Indiana, get this thing solved, and we've got some 600 or 700.
FBI, probably.
Oh my gosh. Yep. You got like 600 or 700 leads. Everybody looks at a composite picture and it looks like somebody. So you're tracking down all these leads. I mean, the case file's over 1,000 pages. I mean, it takes up 2 binders when I copied it.
When you wrote the book, you obviously have written it a couple times. Now that it's been out, what do you think the lesson is here? What can we take from all of this?
Well, I'll tell you the big lesson. Actually, the high school where the boys that were murdered attended, one of their English teachers reached out to me over the holidays because she'd read the book. And she said, I honestly want to have my English class read this for 2 reasons. One, I think they'll be engaged and read. 2, she said, there's kids in our school that are like those other 3, not Drollinger, but the other 3 followers. And she said, I think it'd be a great lesson for them. That's really the lesson, I think, here. You know, a lot of people look at this and go, whew, it'd probably never happen again. I guarantee you, I drive through Crawfordsville. You know, that's where the home county seat where these 4 killers grew up. There's guys walking around there that are fully capable of doing absolutely what they did under the right influence, the right time and circumstances.
I've read something recently that says that the 70s and early 80s was essentially a breeding ground for sociopaths and serial killers. A lot of top stuff we talk about, I look back into true crime, is all that time period in the 70s, 80s, even early 90s. And there's no telling. Not to say that we won't be capable or that the environment won't be similar, but you agree that it's probably, or I think you agree that it could happen again in any time period.
Sure. It was a very unique time period. And I think one of the little known things about this is there was actually another murder a few months after this. A guy named Jerry Turner goes out and kills a farmer named Foxworthy. I can't remember his first name. Somebody he'd worked for, but this is one of Drollinger's kind of little runyons, and he was so upset that he wasn't with him that night. He actually went out and committed a murder just so he could go to prison with Roger. Weird twist.
Manson-like, getting people to kind of like follow him.
Yeah.
And did you ever talk to Drollinger?
He wouldn't. I sent him I don't know how many letters, and actually none of the other three, other than Stonebreaker, spoke to me directly. A lot of them would eventually answer questions through Dan. They would get the letters. So you had Smith and Wright and Stonebreaker all incarcerated in one facility in Pendleton, Indiana. Drollinger was at Michigan City, later transferred where he, you know, had a heart attack, which I think indicates there was probably some mental health issues going on with him later in life. But yeah, none of the other three would participate, actually caused problems with the DOC. Dan Stonebreaker had to put me on his personal visiting list just so I could get access to him and come in and meet.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about before we end the interview? I kind of always leave it up to my interviewee. Sometimes there's something that you thought of as you were driving here or the other day when I asked you.
No, I mean, you know, it's a heavy podcast, but the book's not heavy. I wrote the book. Several versions of the book were very, I would say, Truman Capote-ish, not to his level, but
I love the reference.
Kind of bringing it along,
sure.
You know, in that format. And I had a friend who's a published author read the manuscript one time, and she's heard me speak publicly a million times. And she said, who's writing this? Because that's not your voice. She said, your voice is the humor and things that you use when you speak at conferences. She said, that story is about you as a kid and how this impacted your life. So I actually wrote the book through the eyes of a 9-year-old, and then it transgressed, you know, throughout my life. So there's humor in it. People read it and they're like shocked how you can enter, but it's growing up in a small town.
I love it. Well, people can get the book, Amazon, Choking in Fear. I want to thank you again for coming in and interviewing. We're at a place called Launch Indy. It's a space that is essentially used for businesses and that don't have office space. You can come and use their meeting rooms, and it's in downtown Indianapolis. And like my podcast is, it's Infamous Indy. Would you consider this an infamous Indiana story?
Oh, absolutely.
One of the top.
One of the top stories.
Well, I really appreciate your expertise, the fact that you're a former detective. I interview detectives, and it's fun to talk to you when you're not when you're retired.
And I'm not restrained in what I can say.
Yeah, you can do what you want to do. So,
awesome.
Thank you again, and appreciate it. And everybody, stay tuned for the final part of the episode.
Betty Jane Spencer went on to become a victims' rights activist and eventually was honored at the special White House ceremony by President Ronald Reagan. She died in October 2004. Thank you again for joining me here on Infamous Indy. Stay tuned for more episodes coming out. And if you haven't already, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. You can like my Infamous Indy podcast page on Instagram, and please, please subscribe and comment and rate and review my stuff here on this podcast in whatever capacity you're listening it to. Also, I'd love to hear from you folks. I've been getting a little, some of the emails as the weeks have gone on here to tell me how I'm doing and other story ideas, and I love it. I really, really, really appreciate it because it gives me those ideas to give me the next step and the next story to bring you all. Again, thanks for joining me, and I'm looking forward to the next few weeks. And with that, as I always say, stay safe.